Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Greetings, I'm Andrew McDermott. Today I'm happy to continue my conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Simmons, a retired internal medicine physician and a fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He is author of Billions of Missing Links and What Darwin Didn't Know, both published by Harvest House. Dr. Simmons has studied the human body and evolutionary theory through a career that has spanned 45 years. His latest book is called Are We Here to Recreate Ourselves? The Convergence of Designs. Jeffrey, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Well, let's take a brief look at our senses, and we'll start with vision. What evidence is there for intelligent design when it comes to seeing, to vision?
You know, it's an interesting question because I can't hand you exact design. But if you see footprints in the sand, as people often say, you know there's a human somewhere at the end of these footprints. And so it goes with all kinds of things. You know that something else is present. I mean, like a Christmas tree and presents under it. The kids know that there's a present in those boxes. But you're looking at the wrapping or the bows. And so it goes in a sense with looking at what proves that God did this. Well, look at design. And all these things have to come together at the same time. When you look at the eyes, first of all, there's two of them, and they work together that one can tell depth. They work together when it comes to light and darkness. Both eyes open and close, the pupils open and close. They're set back in the skull so that, for instance, a softball, if it was thrown at somebody or something big hits the head, that the bone protects the eye. There's eyelids that will close the eye, and the eye rolls up. Both of them, that protects the eye. Eyelashes catch lint and things that are in the air. Eyebrows mute sunlight. These all suggest design. There's one on each side. And not only that, but they're kind of at the top of us, the top of our body. So we can see further. And they're able to change. There's so many things. Change. Somebody throws a ball at you from a distance. You're focused on them in the distance, and as the ball is coming closer and closer, you're focused on it closer. But not only that, but you know where it's going to be. You know how fast you need to grab it. It's all connected. There's incredible things going on. And not only that, but in the back of the eye, this mechanisms to catch color and catch black and white cells are purposely geared toward that. The pupil, or lens rather, is clear. These are basically the only cells in the body that are clear. All this suggests engineering, suggests planning or foresight, and certainly to suggest intelligent design.
Yeah, another amazing system. Well, what about our sense of hearing and our sense of smell? Do you see evidence of intelligent design in those systems?
It goes along the same line. Hearing is on two sides, so we can hear. It's sort of a depth perception with ears. The earlobes, even though they look silly to people, are almost like these dish antennas. That's how it works in the biological world for us, to pick up sound and focus it on the ear canal. We listen to a symphony of sounds at all times. Envision actually a symphony, and you're sitting there and you're listening. You can hear everything that's going on as far as the music goes. But now you want to hear what the drummer's doing, or you want to hear what the trumpets are doing, or what the violins are doing. And that's kind of what we're doing when we're hearing. We see a symphony, we hear a symphony, and yet we can sort out all these different instruments as we're listening. So when it comes to ears, there's three bones that are in there that conduct the sounds into the inner ear. Where'd they come from with evolution? You can't find them. The people who believe in evolution think they migrated up from the jaw bones. But there's really no proof of that, and they're only the ones that are found to be separate from the jawbone are only two. So a third one had to come out of somewhere, like a magician of sorts. And they're very small, they're very select in their size and what they do. And they pound on the inner ear, giving sound to a fluid and hairs, nerve hairs of sorts that are in there that conduct the sound to the brain, which sorts it out. Evolution didn't do this, in my mind. It's designed, it's engineered, it's got a purpose.
Yeah, requiring foresight. Well, I know you have some intriguing examples in the circulatory and the nervous systems. Can you share one or two of those?
The one that stands out for me, and I mentioned this, I think, in the previous discussion, is how do evolutionists explain that the nerves cross over? In other words, in the column of nerves going from the left brain to the body crosses over to the right side. And the same thing with the right side crossing over to the left. There's no evolutional reason that I can find to explain why that would help improve things. But it's not just they cross over and they cross over in an organized way. I mean, your left hand is interpreted by your right brain. But the eyes have nerves that go to the brain, and only half of them cross over. So the argument that, oh, maybe the brain twisted or the spinal cord twisted in development, it's maybe a mistake of sorts. Well, how do you get only half an eye nerve going to the other eye? And there's some reasons to think why that is and why it happened, but there's nothing to tell us why it happens with evolution. But stick in one more thing. Even if you think that it can be explained, then one has to go down the lower back and explain why certain nerves come from, like, the right leg. They go up a disc or two or three, and then they cross over. So why do they cross over? I can't explain that on evolution basis, and I can't find anybody else explains it. It's highlighted in my book for a good reason. Same thing with circulation. We talk about, the heart may be evolved from two chambers to three and to four through the animal, lizards, and fish world. It just got bigger, better. But it's also engineered to be pumping blood that we need in certain ways and at certain rates, with certain pressures. It has a pacing system. It has a backup pacing system if that one goes down. And indeed, it has a backup system to the backup system.
Well, it's, as you say, layers of complexity, and it's just amazing systems.
Layers of design, layers of function, layers of convergence.
Now, someone reading your book will find quite a bit of talk about the future of AI, artificial intelligence, and in particular, a discussion of human-like robots or humanoids that imitate human design and may get entrusted with tasks that humans don't like or can't do well. So I wanted to ask you at this point in our discussion, what is your overall attitude towards artificial intelligence? Do you think there are positive aspects to recreating ourselves? And what about the negative consequences?
Well, on a physical level, not going to AI first, I think they're going to dominate lots of areas in our life. They'll be doing dirty jobs. They already are. Fukushima devastation in 2011. Humans can't go in there. In fact, robots are having problems, but humans can't. We're going to be using robots more and more for wars. Maybe the level of casualties on the war field will be less. God knows what it'll be like in the cities for other reasons. We use robots now already for training medical students. I was just at a hospital, University of Illinois, which is basically a facsimile of a real hospital where all the patients are robots or humanoids. And they actually interact with the patients. They talk. You can even do surgery on certain ones, teaching students. And eventually these will be used probably for testing MDs to see if they can continue their credentials. It's quite a challenge for the older doctors, I'm sure. The robots will be doing drudgery, too. They already are. The boring jobs, the cleanup kind of stuff, the stuff that's easy. But we have robots already, humanoids, and greeting people in Japan at department stores. They speak 26 languages and the like. China has robots who are on the screen talking, presenting news. I've seen it. We've had robots on some of the night shows. Sophie is one of them that's known and been around. And so they're coming, and for me, I think also space exploration. We're learning, and it's not publicly known, that I don't think humans will be able to go, given our own technology, beyond Mars. Even Mars is going to be a challenge, but we have something called space brain, where cosmic rays cause brain damage. The twin astronauts, the one that came back, is different height than his twin, who's another astronaut. He has a lot of back problems, which the other one didn't have, and he didn't have before he left. There's other problems. They can't even walk when they come back. So if we're going to send people out to as far distances of space, we're going to have to put them to sleep, suspended animation. You see it a lot in science fiction. But we'd have to put people to sleep. We have to put them to sleep for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Who's going to volunteer for the trial on Earth for 20 years of suspended animation? Nobody. But who can do this? The robots can do this. And we're learning that having them look like us and act like us has a lot of benefits, maybe even make them even bigger, better, stronger than us, faster than us, calculate faster than us. And they can go into a dormant position forever, or figuratively. And so I think they're coming about from AI perspective. you know, I'm not a computer scientist, but I've done a lot of reading on this. And one author in particular, Ray Kurzweil, who's well known about, he's going to think that the robots are going to be just like us and even better in the next 20, 30 years. He has a date. He's moved the date, sort of a moving target. But I don't see where there's certain things about humans will ever happen. I don't know that they'll ever be able to sit with a group, such like group therapy, and interact with all those people and body gestures and body language and different types of tone in their voice. I don't see them talking, being able to handle true compassion. They may be able to fake it, or true empathy, sympathy. Yeah. I don't see them even having the right timing for jokes. Jokes are partly funny because of timing. I think there's a lot of ways to test right now that we think we can figure out a humanoid from a person. Fortunately, humanoids don't look enough like people right now. But if you read my book, you see how we've progressed from dolls to humanoids. They will be looking more and more like us. Their hands are working more and more like us. Their feet are working more like us. They walk more and more like us. It's going to be very difficult to tell them apart. They're probably going to look a little bit like Data on Star Trek. They're not going to have the feelings, I don't think. I don't think they're going to have a soul. And I talk about a soul a lot in my book. What is it? What do we think it is? That's the spark of life. There's something else within us that I don't think we can copy.
Well, you know, there's such a thing as unique humanness and to be uniquely human. And as much as we try to copy that with robots and machines and artificial intelligence, we're only going to get so far. And I guess a lot depends on the goals of AI programs and the ethical decisions made. We are in uncharted territory, but we do have to, you know, not lose sight of what it means to be human, and we don't want to cede too much control to machines. I suppose robots can be helpful in limited capacities, as you're saying, you know, space travel and the drudgery and certain things that humans either don't want to do or can't do very well. But we probably do have to be careful when it comes to these things.
You know, they're a necessity for the future. Without doubt, especially with wars. And boy, I'll tell you, whoever is the programmer is the one who's going to decide how good or bad they are. I wrote a book, a novel, a lot of years ago called Murdoch, which in those days, the knowledge about computers was much less, but about a malevolent computer in a hospital. You know, that was what I knew because I'm a doctor. But I think there's going to be malevolent people doing malevolent things. There already are, and history is full of them, and they've just come out in the form of robots. I think we're in for challenges that we've never seen and haven't anticipated.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing with your book, and that is to look closely at the human design and the human body and really open up the evidence that's there. I think that will help as we move into the future, and you know, it'll give us a lot to work with and also a lot to safeguard at this point.
I agree. I'm worried. I'm excited about the future, and I'm worried. Part of me would like to go into suspended animation and see what it's going to be like later on. And part of me says, I don't want to be here when all this comes about. But it's very, very interesting to think about, debate, and to write about.
It sure is. Well, Jeff, that's all we can pack into this episode, I'm afraid. But we'll come back for more conversation, one more episode, where we'll discuss human thinking and memory and the convergent design that's in play in those processes. And we'll also take another look at the pros and cons of humans recreating themselves. Jeffrey, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
Well, if you've enjoyed our chat about Are We Here to Recreate Ourselves, get yourself a copy on Amazon. And if you haven't listened to the first part of my chat with Dr. Simmons, find it and plenty other episodes at idthefuture.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for tuning in. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.